And my special guest in the studio tonight is a laureate in no less than three European conservatories. He's performed internationally with his quartet since 2004 and won numerous music awards, including the prestigious Tremplin Jazz d'Avignon in Paris. The vibraphonist is currently in Australia touring his latest quartet album, Bang My Can. Pascal Schumacher, welcome to Now's the Time.
Happy to be here.
And joining Pascal in the studio as well is the bass player from his quartet, Chris Devashier. And welcome to you, Chris.
Thank you.
Pascal, how did you come to start playing the vibraphone? What other instruments are you proficient at?
I basically started as a classical percussionist, training in Luxembourg Conservatory. Well, if you're a percussionist, in the first moment, you have to make choices at some point. So you study all these instruments at the same time, and you have to choose whether you're going to become a timpani player in a symphonic orchestra or a drummer in a rock band or maybe something else. And I was more attracted to the melodic percussion instruments like the xylophone, the marimbaphone, and the most magical one of all those is the vibraphone in my eyes. And that's how it started. And I started studying abroad, Luxembourg, having already made the choice to not become an orchestral musician. I had to play a lot of contemporary music because Mozart and Bach didn't write concertos for vibraphone and marimbaphone. So it happened that my teacher at some point asked me to get a bit into improvisation and to try to get a bit looser, a bit freer. Because many of the contemporary composers, of course, they like to have moments of improvise, and I was not so good in that.
So what age did you develop this love of improvising?
This happened around 14, when I was 14, 15 years old, so with this guy. And then, of course, real studying started when I was 19, 20. And then I thought it would be so much cooler to play jazz music than contemporary music. Yeah, it's just much more fun.
Look, I had to go all the way back to 1997 in my Downbeat magazine collection to find a story on a high-profile vibraphone player. Now, it was an article on the duo of Chick Corea and Gary Burton. The fact that Downbeat are not writing about vibraphone players tells me it's not a very sexy instrument. What is it in particular about the vibes that makes it attractive to you?
I think the vibraphone was an extremely sexy instrument in the 40s, and even maybe in the 50s. Then in the 70s, when the Fender Rhodes appeared, the vibraphone got a huge crisis. There were people playing with 10 fingers, so much faster and a much larger range than the vibraphone. So it completely fall away. And luckily, there were people like Gary Burton coming up and bringing the bits back to the studios and to the stages. Nowadays, I believe that the vibraphone is living a real renaissance and is much, much more played than maybe 15 years ago. Even pop bands like to add the color, and it's a different color than the Fender Rhodes. And also now, with having 20 or 30 years history of Fender Rhodes, this instrument has a certain connotation, and we have heard it a lot in funk music, in soul music, in certain kinds of music, that the vibraphone brings a very new, fresh sound. So I think it's going better, slowly, slowly.
And Chris, tell us about your background now. As a bass player, when did you start becoming interested in jazz music?
Well, I started actually very late. I studied classical piano and classical saxophone and then discovered speed metal. And I started playing bass in there because there weren't enough bass players available at the time. Yeah, the jazz courses at uni just started when I was looking for an opportunity to kind of broaden my musical approach to things. So I enrolled in the conservatorium, I was accepted, and then I actually was only interested in rock and pop music. But then this jazz, I went to see a jazz concert of a couple of my teachers. It was a fantastic trio, Chris de Fort trio with Dre Palamart and Nick Tyson. I was blown away, and I decided to stop everything that I was doing before and just completely went for the double bass, and that was 16, 17 years ago. So, yeah.
And was it the idea of being able to improvise? Was that the essence of what attracted you?
What attracted mainly was the sound, because I think that music, the biggest parameter in music is sound, and I'm not the only one who thinks about that. I think that There's one guy sitting next to me who agrees with that. And it's just the sound that was sticking in my ears, and I just had to figure it out for myself, what I could bring to the music. So improvisation is just a part of it. It's also working together, working in a team, which is the case with this band, that makes it possible to develop on a personal musical level.
Well, working in a team, there's a quite a unique intuitive dynamic happening, I felt, on Friday night in your Melbourne performance. Mm-hmm. How have you been able to develop that? I know you've been together, what, since 2002, but...
We have the chance to play quite a lot. That's, I think, in any way, the best thing to do if you want to get a band really together. And the vision of what we're doing is really the band vision. It's not it's not about the strong soloists. It's not about virtuosity. I really like to get one fat band sound happening together, and we work the four of us in the music and all the pieces, even if it says we just heard El Marno, written by Christoph, but everybody contributed to the version, so everybody had little ideas, we've tried out little things, and it would be more right to say that every piece belongs to everybody, because it's everybody contributing, and that's what makes it maybe what you described, feel that everybody knows exactly what's happening, and we are, yeah, completely in this together.
But of course, being jazz, the performances would naturally change from night to night. How different do you perceive the performances to be from night to night when you're improvising?
Mm-hmm. Of course, the improvised areas in the music we do are improvised, so they are different. But a lot of the things are the orchestrations and the arrangements are quite go quite far, and we add here and there new ideas, maybe from night to night, that we say, because we like, for example, to record concerts that we do, listen to them back in the car, and then maybe there was a little mistake played by the drummer, but it was exactly at the same moment that the bass player also made a little mistake, and it sounded great together. So it becomes a new arrangement that we integrate in the music.
That's the great thing about jazz.
I think that's important, if you're not willing to take any risks, and then a mistake doesn't become a mistake once, or a problem is not a problem once it's solved. So that means that there's a bond in the band, and that there's a lot of trust in the band, so it's strong enough to survive little escapades that might be normally ruining the arrangement.
I spoke with the Gypsy Jazz guitarist Lulo Reinhardt in recent times on this program as well, and that was one of his comments, that he felt as though he makes a lot of mistakes, but that's because he's reaching for a lot of risks as well on stage, and it's part of his actual enjoyment of the process of making music.
No risk, no fun.
Now, the music contained in the new album, Bang My Can, to me, when I first heard this and reviewed it for ABC Limelight magazine, I felt it had a great sense of humour about the music as well. What did you set out to achieve with the feel of the album? Was I correct in the sense of humour that's coming through in the music?
I think we like to take us very serious, but when we start to do it too much, we have to laugh about ourselves. There's, for example, the most serious piece on this album, which is maybe very actual at this moment, is a piece called No Dance on Volcano Ashes. It's a piece that I wrote because I was angry that I couldn't fly to Birmingham to play a concert, which I really wanted to play. So I wrote this dramatic piece. Initially, it should be the last piece in the album with a dramatic ending. And we played a few versions. We had some really nice dramatic endings. And then we thought, let's do another version, a better dramatic ending. And it completely went wrong. And we had a laugh, and Jens was playing a bass drum kick to finish this all, and Franz also played a really weird cadenza, and we decided, okay, this is more Pascal Schumacher Quartet than this super dramatic opera thing. So that maybe answers your question.
I think it does, because that's where I got picked up that feel on that particular track. Pascal, you've been involved in writing for film, theatre and dance projects. Last Friday night in Melbourne, when you performed the piece written by yourself, Christoph, A Fisherman's Tale, dedicated to your father, I'm sure everyone in the house at Bennett's Lane last Friday night felt as though they were alone aboard a fishing boat in the early morning. That's how I felt. Do you find those dramatic aspects informs your approach to jazz?
For me, music is music, and I'm sitting here in a jazz station or jazz, and I play in jazz clubs and often in jazz clubs, jazz festivals. But some people think that what we do is not jazz. And if I write, in my eyes, classical music, people think that it's jazz. So the borders are getting very loose, and I think we just write and do the music that we like most at this moment. There are other people who say about our music that it's pop music with improvisations and without vocals. Other people think that it's contemporary music with a jazzy pop touch. And there are so many ways of describing what we do, so that I believe you cannot describe it. It's just what the four of us want to do. And of course, I write music for other things, but also the other members of the music, they are involved in very different projects. And all this brought together in a rehearsal or in a recording studio or on a festival stage makes just what we are, and that only music.
Only music. What observations do you make in relation to the differences in Australian audiences to those you experience in Europe?
Till now, for this tour, we played 3 shows, and they were extremely enthusiastic and very nice and especially grateful, maybe a bit more grateful than we are used to it in Europe, even though we are lucky with nice publics also. Since we're playing in many different European countries, it's very different. Countries.
Tougher audiences?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Often if you go to the big cities, it's tougher to play. And if you get to the smaller cities, they get more grateful that you pass by and you play for them. And they don't have that much choice, and they cannot just say, oh no, we don't go to see that because this is not famous enough. We want only the concerts where we have to pay $100 to get in. That's the real thing. So in the smaller places, you get oft more response. But I like play also in London or in Paris.
Now, your website states that you're currently writing music for a soundtrack to a silent movie starring Marlene Dietrich.
Yes.
Either you haven't updated your website in a while, or you look extremely young for your age. Can you describe what this is all about?
It's about a commission that I got from the Luxembourg Philharmonie. They have a concert series called Cinema Concerts, where they always have silent movies,
okay,
which get a new score. Sometimes they also take the original scores, but then they have to be restored, and there's quite a lot of... I don't know if silent movies with live music have a place in Australia yet or not. It's very much coming in Europe.
Okay.
Also, contemporary music festivals, they like to have it because it attracts people, because you have one more argument to get the people. And
sometimes it's even completely improvised. They put a band there and they improvise on the images.
One that comes to mind recently was the Jack DeJohnette concert at the Sydney Opera House Opera Theatre, where he did a tribute to the Jack Johnson album by Miles Davis.
Yeah.
And that documentary was being portrayed. But that wasn't a silent movie, although much of the footage, given the time, was actually silently recorded at the time. But there was a narration around it as well.
I think it's a really nice thing to do, because you have this movie, you have these images, and you can add a really contemporary notion to it and to get it really accessible for the people. And it's beautiful pictures, and they didn't have the technical possibilities that exist today, but they had extraordinary eyes, and they shot some really nice sceneries and if you put Marlene Dietrich in it anyway, it looks amazing.
No, of course.
It's very inspiring.
The piano player in the quartet, if I'm correct, mm-hmm, previous to Franz was Jeff Nev.
Mm-hmm.
But you continue a duo with him. Was this in any way the idea of this duo inspired by Chick Corea and Gary Burton, or is it just something that just grew organically?
Both, I think. I mean, of course, Jeff listened to Chick Corea playing with Gary Burton, and I listened to Gary Burton playing with Chick Corea while studying music. And in fact, the first concert we played in duo was happening because we should play with the quartet, and the drummer wasn't available. And Christoph was there, in fact, at the very first concert we played in duo. Yeah. Well, we just said, okay, let's do it in duo once. And we didn't have repertoire for that, so we played also some of the classics that the Burton Korea duo does. But very fast we found out that, of course, we are not Burton Korea, but we are Schumacher Neve, and we have our own voice and our own way to find. And so that's how the project got up, and it was organically working very nicely till the beginning, and connected to our friendship, this makes sense.
And Chris, who would you nominate as some of your major influences on the double bass?
On the double bass, first of all, the first person I really listened to on the double bass was Ray Brown. And that, for me, punch sound is amazing. Then I also listen a lot to Charles Mingus, and my hero today is definitely Dave Holland. He's one of the most inspiring players, also visually, to look at, because it's amazing when you see somebody on stage enjoying himself rather than going through pain, which is what music is not supposed to be. It's supposed to be fun.
That's right, yes.
And he really radiates that, and every time I see him play, it just makes me feel warm, very warm. And of course, there's some other, Charlie Hayden is somebody I love as well. I had the pleasure last year to have him at the school where I teach, the conservatory where I teach, to have him for 3 days. And it was very inspiring to be around Charlie Hayden.
It's Metamorphosis, and this is from the newest member of the group, the pianist Franz von Schossi. You might want to briefly describe that in the fashion that you did the other night, Pascal.
It's I like to call it a symphony because I think this piece has all the movements a symphony would have, even though it's only one movement. It's a piece that Franz wrote thinking about the human life. It's from the very beginning when you just start moving, maybe still inside your mom's body, till the very end where you just move as little as in the very beginning. At some point he wanted to change the title. That's what I explained to people in Melbourne. Since the song is called Metamorphosis, the changing of the human body, because there are a lot of little layers who pop up and who disappear, and you can have this little, it has a real evolution going on. And then he wanted to call it a lifetime.
Lifeline.
And none of the members of the band thought that that was a very inspired title. And so when we went to the recording studio, he said that he was okay now to go back to the initial title, which is Metamorphosis.
Thanks very much for joining me in the studio tonight.
Thank you for inviting us.